Next case is 04-2114, Cleveland Bar Association versus Sharp Estate Services. Mr. Hollenbaum.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, Chief Justice Moyer, members of the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, if I may, please. Excuse me. My name is Richie Hollenbaum. I'm here on behalf of the estate plan and Henry Abst. I'm not here on behalf of Mr. Sharp or his organizations, nor am I here on behalf of Robert Klappas or any of the other persons or entities involved in this matter involving the unauthorized practice of law. This case is about how much the court will restrict what Henry Abst and company will say about living trusts. The evidence presented in this case over a two-day period of time was substantial and carefully presented by other counsel as well as by Mr. Koenig. It was originally filed in February of 2002, and the hearing was in July of 2003, and the decision was not rendered until December of 2004. The case comes down to a significant amount of evidence that is an issue that has troubled this state for some time, dealing with trusts and the sale of trusts by persons other than lawyers. In this case, the estate plan is a company from Nevada that has, for a number of years, produced documents that are estate planning documents, primarily a living trust.
Counsel.
One of the things that keeps troubling me is TEP's main defense is we tell our people repeatedly not to practice law. We put it in bold print in our documents, and Mr. Sharp went off on his own and practiced law. But then all of the documentation, all the training manuals, all the evidence presented that I could see basically told him how to practice law. Here's how you advise the people. Here's what you say to them. Here's what you do. So that the disclaimer was like window dressing for trying to get you out of this very type of case, but the reality in practice was you go out and talk to these people about what they need, and then an attorney comes in at the tail end to sort of give it its blessing. How do you defend that as being not practicing law when the actions, I guess the best phrase to use is the actions speak louder than the words?
Your Honor, I'm not going to try to defend that as not being the practice of law. I think that studying the record, looking at the evidence that was presented, and studying those points that you addressed just now can lead to the conclusion that what in fact was happening up until January of 2003 was exactly that. And the court has held in any number of cases before involving discipline of various persons, including several from Columbus, that the in-home solicitation of persons to adopt something that affects their legal rights is in fact the practice of law. I think that the evidence that was presented in this case very likely establishes that. So what this case is about is the process, and we are here to argue about what the remedy should be and what the rule should be in Ohio with respect to these types of cases. This is the first instance in which this particular set of facts has come from this side of the equation involving UPL. The other side has, involving the lawyers and the assistants in unauthorized practice, have been many and are well documented, and the court's ruling with respect to that is clear to me. And it is clear to my clients as to what they can and cannot do with respect to in-home solicitations. But this case, then, is what is the rule, what are they permitted to do going forward, and what will this court permit a company or an individual who has particular opinions and particular studied and learned matters with respect to trusts of this nature, what can that person tell the public? This case is not about the quality of these documents. There was no evidence presented whatsoever in this case with respect to whether or not the actual documents in question were adequate for the job that they were enlisted for, or whether they were appropriate for the persons to whom they were given. And there was evidence given that living trust can be appropriate for people in many different types of circumstances.
Counsel?
Yes, sir.
Rather than ask you a bunch of questions, I will just throw my prejudice about these matters out on the table and let you knock them down. These kind of activities, to me, seem to be just blatant consumer fraud that these companies are out there marketing to people who, first of all, don't even need living trusts, that they're inappropriate given the level of assets that they have, and I have the impression that they don't screen that at all. And secondly, the principal reason advocated for doing this is in order to see to it that you can stick the government with your care in a nursing home if that's ever required at the end of life, and that you can essentially move your assets over to your children and not be obligated to the things that we should be obligated for. And the Congress and the legislatures have to keep changing the law to try and make it more difficult for people of means to empty themselves out in terms of end-of-life care. To me, that's just a basically a fraudulent scheme, and my impression is these people are participants in that. So disabuse me of that, would you?
Well, first of all, the general view that you expressed is that which is generally held by much of the organized bar. And I need to acknowledge that to begin with, that many of the trust mills that have been brought to the court's attention in the various cases that have preceded this one have been found to have some of those characteristics. This particular organization, this particular person, though, there's no evidence in this record with respect to any of those issues. And to paint the estate plan and to paint Henry Abst with that broad brush is contradictory and contrary to the evidence that's presented in this record. Secondly, as to your point with respect—
Well, is there evidence in the record that there's some sort of screening as to assets that one has that would, I mean, wouldn't you agree that there's some asset threshold below which a living trust just wouldn't make any sense?
Yes, in most cases, okay. And even in very low asset cases, there are particular reasons for there to be trusts.
Sure.
There are exceptions. And the testimony in this case by Henry Abst was, in fact, when he got the one example that was presented to him during the testimony in this case, he acknowledged that absent some additional factor, some reason for the particular person to enter into a living trust, that the assets in that case were below that which would...
Well, did your client offer any information that indicates that he or his company screens the prospects to make sure that they have the people of means that really would benefit from engaging in this kind of a
Mr. Apst has been in this particular line of business for a substantial period of time. He has very strong beliefs that most people can benefit from a living trust.
So anybody qualifies?
Not everybody qualifies, and he acknowledged that in his testimony. But nonetheless, he did in fact acknowledge in the one example that was given to him when he was on the stand under cross-examination that that person did not qualify.
Counsel, is the practice now within this business still the concept of using a hub attorney, I believe was the word to use, or that is being used as a someone who issues their imprimatur on the trust?
Well, since January of 2003, this company has ceased doing that particular business in Ohio.
Okay, but
and going
should you resurrect for any reason, is that the business profile? Is that how you operate?
I don't anticipate that that's what's going to occur once this court rules with respect to this case. I don't believe that using an attorney in the way that the attorneys in this case were employed, that they were in the various other cases were employed, that the court has
We haven't sanctioned that model of operation. Is
exactly.
That okay.
Exactly.
All right.
So this case going forward will depend significantly on what standards this court sets and what results from this particular hearing. Now,
and your biggest concern at this point is any sanctions, correct?
My biggest concern.
Monetary sanctions.
That's a very substantial concern at this point. Yes.
Why don't you address that?
All right. The monetary sanctions requested in this case are enormously large. There's the issue with respect to retroactivity that has been raised and briefed. This case has been briefed extensively, and that issue is briefed extensively as well. I would like to point out that for there to be a penalty, there should be a finding of wrongdoing. The board, in this case, considered that question, and they made no finding or recommendation with respect to penalty. They only recommended that there be an injunction granted. In the prior cases where this court has imposed a $1,000 penalty, in those two cases, there was indication and evidence that the person had in fact been told that their specific conduct was a violation and they should cease, but nonetheless they continued to do it. The amount per offense, which is what the rule says, is a maximum of $10,000. Well, inherent in that is the proof that there was an offense, which would indicate that there would need to be evidence presented in the record that a person received a trust from this organization and that it was in violation of the unauthorized practice.
So every trust that had been issued in the state of Ohio for X amount of time would have to be examined and part of the and testimony and scrutinized as to the process and whether it was violative. We can't look at the whole model that was used within the state of Ohio and attribute those techniques to the entire sales of these items?
I think that you can look at the entire process and look at the and determine what the appropriate process is and where the process violates the law. But with respect to the substance, with respect to whether or not there has been an offense for which there is authority under the rule to impose a penalty, there must be evidence, there must be proof that there was, in fact, an offense. And that, I believe, should be done offense by offense by offense, rather than painting a broad brush and saying, because there's some evidence that there are over 400 trusts, that each should be penalized $10,000, and the requested amount, it becomes totally astronomical.
The necessity for an examination offense by offense, et cetera, do you have authority for that?
No, I don't. I don't believe that that issue has been examined. This is a new rule. It's a rule that just went into effect in 2003, and it has been, I believe, applied two occasions. And in those two occasions, the penalty was for $1,000.
For a single offense or for a multitude of offenses?
For a single offense, I believe.
Okay.
I see my lights flashing. Am I?
Thank you, Mr. Hallenbaugh. Mr. Kudyk.
May it please the court, my name is David Kudyk, and along with John Hallbauer, I represent the Cleveland Bar Association. I'd like to reserve 1 minute of my time for rebuttal, since we did provide objections to the court. This case presents a very important issue for those of us who are involved in the prosecution of unauthorized practice of law and for the court. And that issue is not whether these folks committed the unauthorized practice of law. I think Mr. Hallenbaugh basically conceded that they did. The issue before this court is whether, given the respondents' continued, numerous, and flagrant instances of unauthorized practice of law, whether this court will issue substantial civil penalties and specific and meaningful injunctive relief. Under Section 8D, of this court's Rule 7 for the government of the bar, the court has laid out a number of criteria that it would look at in deciding whether it would level civil penalties. And when you look at each of those criteria, significant penalties are required here. Starting with the number, we have in Exhibit 76 a bunch of invoices for a period of about 2 years. They're a partial compilation of invoices. There are 468 instances of sales to these documents to folks in Ohio.
What's the gross on that?
The estate plan received anywhere between $300 to over $2,000 a pop. And I haven't done the math, but I think the average would be somewhere between $500 and $1,000 for that period of time. Now, the advisor who worked for the estate plan in Ohio, a man by the name of Jeff Sharp, another person who was a respondent in this case, he testified that in his work for the estate plan, there were over 1,000 clients, or about 1,000 clients, that he worked on and that he delivered trusts to. So there clearly are a number of instances in this case. Another factor is whether there was flagrant violations. Well, as Justice Stratton pointed out, they have these warnings that say don't engaged in the unauthorized practice of law. So they know that it's a problem. But they don't do anything other than put these warnings in. And in fact, as Justice Stratton pointed out, all these warnings are there for is so that they could come into proceedings like this and say, oh, well, we've warned these folks not to practice law, when what they in fact do is tell them to practice law. Mr. Henry Abst admitted on the stand that the job of an advisor is to suggest and recommend that particular individuals get specific types of living trusts. That's the practice of law. That's what they train these individuals to do. And of course, there's also the Kathman case. The Kathman case was an attorney disciplinary case. Mr. Kathman was found by this court to have done, among other things, aided and abetted the unauthorized practice of law. The folks that he was aiding and abetting were the estate plan. So they were well aware of the problem here in Ohio, that these activities were the unauthorized practice of law, yet they continued to engage in those practices. Another thing the court's supposed to look at is cooperation with the proceedings. And they have not cooperated with proceedings in spades. As an example, And it's come into this court today, as a matter of fact, a consequence of what they've done. We asked them for the addresses, the names, the telephone numbers of all the clients that they had in Ohio. They were ordered by the board twice to provide that information. After they were ordered the first time, they said, you know, we don't see any reason that we have to provide that information. That was after they were told by the board to do so. Second time we go to the board, second time in an order. Then they tell us, well, we'll give you that stuff after we have notified the clients. That was in July of 2003, and we still haven't gotten the information. So when Mr. Hollenbaugh comes up here and says there should be a case-by-case examination, well, they should be a stop from making that argument because they didn't provide us with that information after they were ordered twice to do so. They also destroyed information. We asked for access codes to certain portions of their websites. After the board ordered them to give us the access, within 2 weeks, they changed their website, and they destroyed all information about what was behind those access codes. And they said, those access codes, those areas don't exist anymore. Well, if you look at their website today, theestateplan.com, you'll see that those particular portions of the website are up again. And they continued during these proceedings to dissemble at almost every turn. If you look at the testimony of the president of their organization, Chris Abst, he denied that they sell living trusts. They said, we don't sell living trusts. We don't make sales presentations. We sell, quote, the idea of living trusts. That's despite the fact that they have a sales department, that they have a sales and marketing manual that they use to provide, to train these folks, that they provide a sales kit to their advisors, which they market as, quote, the last marketing piece you'll ever need to make a sale, end quote. And in their workbooks that they give to individuals, to fill out along with the advisor, they have a purchase agreement. Their marketing materials talk about buying the right documents from the right company.
Can you address their argument that it is inappropriate to give a blanket fine for every sale made and that you have to, in fact, address each trust and harm it individually did?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that they did not give us information that we could go investigate the 468 or the 1,000 instances should prevent them from saying here, well, you didn't prove it, since they didn't give us that information. We got exemplar files. We got basically three files. And in each one of those files, it showed rampant excesses. For example, there was a family called the Lupfers. They had an estate of $75,000. And even Mr. Abst, Henry Abst, said that those folks really shouldn't have had a trust. There was another family, the Petrus family. After their $120,000 house, they had an estate of less than $45,000. They shouldn't have had a trust. A third file that we have was from a woman by the name Beatrice Pfeiffer. She was blind, and after she found an attorney with the Cleveland Bar Association, she canceled her order. So in each instance that we saw, the limited instances that we saw, there were significant overreaching by these folks.
Counsel, you've advocated that, A, we have a significant civil penalty, and so following up on Justice O'Connor, I'd ask you what that should be. But you also indicated that we should follow the board's recommendation and impose what you termed to be a meaningful injunction.
Correct.
So could you flesh that out? I think we're always looking for creative ways to see to it that what we intend to happen actually does happen. So could you flesh that out?
Sure. Let me deal with the injunction first, then I want to go back to the issue of the amount of the penalties. In the Hanna case, this court enjoined the respondent from counseling individuals with respect to their legal rights or preparing documents that secure legal rights. And in other cases, this court has enjoined the marketing and sale of living trusts. That's a good start for an injunction. We have also asked for, as was the case that this court ordered in the Kolodner case, and I was one of the trial team for the Ohio State Bar Association in that case, that they be required to provide a notice to all of their clients in Ohio that they engaged in the unauthorized practice of law that this court so found, and that they should advise these folks to go to lawyers independent of the estate plan or anyone affiliated with the estate plan to go review their estates. That's the three pieces that we would ask that this court do as far as an injunction. In terms of the amount of the penalty.
Let me just stop you. I suppose that would be at a cost to the persons who hire a lawyer to review their trust. What should we do about that? Anything?
Well, I certainly, Your Honor, could suggest, as I think was the case in Klodner, that the estate plan be required to absorb the cost of that review. In terms of.
Would it be appropriate if we award a fine that the fine be set up as a fund to fund those costs, or is that should be in addition?
Well, Your Honor, I would say that should be additional because certainly they should bear the cost of the mandatory injunction that we're asking for, that the that people's estates be remedied by their unauthorized practice. I think in terms of a penalty, that's to serve, quite frankly, a punitive function, and these folks deserve to be punished due to the lack of cooperation, due to the flagrant violations. I mean, for example, they said that they're not practicing or they're not doing anything in Ohio. They said that in July of 2003. Well, attached to our reply brief, our post-hearing reply brief below, Mr. Hallbauer had an affidavit, Exhibit C. Exhibit 1 to that affidavit is a solicitation piece called the Living Trust Times from the estate plan, dated October 2003, sent to someone in Navarre, Ohio, soliciting them for a trust amendment. So even when they say we're not involved in solicitation or activities in Ohio, they still are.
Let me take you back to the sanctions. You indicated that you were interested in a notice to their clients, but are you not seeking a listing or some revealing to the bar of who those clients are? You hadn't mentioned that, I don't believe.
Yes, well, that was in our brief, and certainly that's something I think we need to basically monitor what they're doing. We want to be able to have that authority to determine that they have indeed sent the notices that we suggest be sent, and that they have accurately helped folks out find lawyers that need to have their estates reviewed.
Counsel, don't we have a retroactivity concern over these penalties that you're seeking?
No, we don't. This court has always, under Article 4 of the Ohio Constitution, had the plenary authority to regulate the practice of law and determine what remedies there should be for the unauthorized practice of law. And the real question with respect to retroactivity is this. Would it be reasonable for someone in 2002, 2001, 2000 to come into Ohio, know that they're in violation of the law, engaged in unauthorized practice of law, and think there would be no monetary consequences as a result of that activity? The answer is no. And given this court's plenary authority, this court can go ahead and levy those sanctions as we've requested and suggested.
Although you're saying that there were in fact incidences after the
change in the rules.
Correct.
I believe June of 2003.
Correct.
So I mean, if we were concerned about the retroactivity situation, we could look prospectively.
Yes, although to be accurate, Your Honor, we were not able to find any specific instances in the first half of 2003 due to the fact they stiff-armed us with discovery. We did find one instance of solicitation, as I mentioned, in October of 2003. They've also made a big deal below about this notion that the attorney is in control. That was their real trump card, that since the attorney's involved, the attorney's in control. But if you look at their website today, theestateplan.com, in the area where you want to look to see whether you're going to be or you might be an independent advisor, they say currently you may be giving your estate planning needs to an attorney, and that may result in the potential loss of revenue and puts the attorney between you and the client. And then it goes on to say, instead, I, that's Mr. Abst, am offering you a system that keeps you in control at all times and makes the client want to contact you first. That's what they want to do. So unless you give them a substantial penalty, and unless you give them a serious and significant injunction, they'll continue to do what they did in the past. It's clear, as they ask or instruct their salespeople to do in the homes of our elderly, they will say anything and do anything to keep making a buck in Ohio.
What amount of fine or penalty are you seeking?
Your Honor, I think given the flagrancy of the conduct here, given how they treated us below and how they treated the board below, that they deserve the maximum $10,000 fine for each instance, for the minimum number of the instances that we were able to prove fraud in 68, which would be $4,680,000. We think that's the appropriate penalty here.
Counsel, if you would get a clients list that would indicate more than the 468, I mean, are we premature on what you're asking here in light of the fact that you've been stymied with discovery?
Your Honor, I would be more than glad to come back and give you an exact figure for a penalty. But I think as a starter, you could start at $4.68 million.
Your Honor, well, we wouldn't have an ongoing case that will start with the four, if we would, 4.6 to be added to. There's no certainty or value of doing that.
Well, Your Honor, this is a matter in which the court does have original jurisdiction.
Right.
So that you could do that if you wished, I believe. Right. Your Honor, I see my time is up, and I would request at least a minute for a rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Cootie. Mr. Hollenbaugh, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
Oh, I used my entire time.
Pardon? You did use your entire time.
Well, let me then.
Counsel,
briefly,
before you get to that, let me ask you a question. What is there any internet solicitation being done from Ohio clients? Is there the possibility that someone in Ohio can still link up with your client and have an estate plan, a trust, a living trust, whatever, via the internet?
I don't know for sure, but I believe that probably could happen, yes.
So you're still practicing in Ohio? Or your client, excuse me, is still offering the services that they claim to have ceased and desisted to Ohio residents under the same format as previously done?
No. No. What was previously done and the conduct that was most vigorously opposed was the in-home solicitation, the face-to-face solicitation by an individual who is not a lawyer in the home with individuals.
Correct.
That's far different than having an opportunity on the internet for someone to choose. It's very much like going to the bookstore and pulling a book off for self-help, for a self-divorce, for a self-will, for a self-DUI. Every bookstore has a section with self-help books. And there are plenty of people within the country that want that opportunity. And what I hear you say is that there's an inclination, perhaps, or a possibility of saying to an individual, you can't say that, or you can't provide that information. And you're placing
So let me understand then. The service that your client is currently engaged in with Ohio citizens is to give them a blank set of documents. They fill in the blanks themselves?
No.
Do they tailor the forms for the individual? Does the individual, in other words, log on, fill out a questionnaire, and then your client emails or mails them the documents they need for a trust?
I can't assert one way or another what that would be, what would be available to them.
So you don't know what they're doing. You can't make any representations as to what their internet business is like in Ohio with Ohio residents.
Today? No. I didn't go on the website to look to see what was doing. I was dealing with a record and the proof that was presented at the hearing.
Okay.
Right.
Very quickly.
Am I done?
You can have one thought.
My one thought is that the concept of penalty should be directly related to an offense. And in this case, the offense that is being claimed is a broad brush of what all living trust mills or living trust organizations do,
what's occurred
in this case.
What do you think the appropriate penalty should be if, in fact, we impose a penalty here?
I think that an injunction would be appropriate in this case, but in terms of a monetary penalty, because this organization is being painted with a broad brush of others that have done the same thing. In this particular case, there was no evidence presented that indicated that there was harm done to any person. There was no evidence that any of the documents were inappropriate.
What about disclosure of the list of clients or customers?
I would certainly point out that all of that information, all of those allegations, all of those claims were before this UPL panel, and that it was in a very aggressive panel that questioned very carefully and very, very thoroughly.
Mr. Kudyk says they've been stymied on two occasions by your client.
I'm sorry?
He says that your client has put him off on two occasions and refused.
Well, he also says a lot of other things about how awful these documents are and the harm to the public. But he may be confusing this case with the many others that he's prosecuted. In this case, there's nothing in the record to indicate that. There's certainly nothing in the report from the UPL committee in their recommendation for anything beyond an injunction. And had the offenses been as flagrant as represented here, certainly this panel would have done something more than suggest or recommend an injunction.
Thank you, Mr. Hollenbaugh.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Kudyk, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
There were three instances that we knew of, and each of the three instances there was overreaching, as I mentioned earlier. In terms of how they operate today, look at Exhibit 82, which is a solicitation that was done without an attorney for an amendment to the trust. That's how they operate in Ohio today. You can also look at about Exhibit 63 or 64, the printouts from their website. And basically how that operates is somebody calls them, and then they refer somebody to an advisor or a planner in Ohio. That's how they operate with their website. And my final observation is that I would urge the court to fashion its own remedy rather than to remand this case. This case has been pending since February of 2002. These folks continue to operate in Ohio, and the remedy needs to be fashioned, and it needs to be fashioned now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kudyk. The case is submitted. You be advised of our opinion.